This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Hello, and welcome to episode 11 of the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Burgun. Today, we're going to be talking to Charles Pratt. He's a teacher of game design at the NYU Game Center. And so without any further ado, here's the interview. You're a teacher there, is that right?
Yeah, I'm an assistant arts professor here.
Cool. What does that specifically mean? Like, I saw that you teach a bunch of classes there, but like, what?
Yeah. It's a certain title. We don't have tenure here, so we have arts professorships. So that's just what we get called instead of regular professors.
Interesting. What kinds of classes do you teach there and stuff?
Yeah, so I teach a little bit of everything. Most of the time I'm teaching I'm teaching a class called Thinking About Games that is also called Intro to Game Studies, depending on who you are. I teach that in our BFA, and that's kind of just a survey of, I like to say game studies, but we tend to read a lot that's outside of game studies proper. Very early stuff like, I don't know if your readers are familiar with people like Huizinga or Kaiwa, or sort of the very early, people that were looking at games and play and trying to figure out what they were and what they meant and how they fit into society. And, so I teach that course. I also head up our course Games 101, which is our history course, our introductory history course, which all our students are required to take. And that's just, we just talk about, games from ancient board games all the way up to esports and contemporary indie games and that sort of thing. So we try to cover the vast history of games, just in an effort to give our students an understanding of how big a category games are and how many possibilities there are for design. And also to give them, to make sure that they have some kind of common language, right? So they all know what Tetris is, they all know what Magic the Gathering, and they all know what Go is. So there's that. I teach some stuff on narrative. I have occasionally taught a class on narrative in games, specifically video games. Mm-hmm. I teach some game design sometimes. I tend to be someone who basically fills in the gaps. I don't necessarily have like a specialty.
Gotcha.
So yeah.
Cool. So we've talked. We usually talk at practice. I think that's where I met you. And so you did this talk at NYU called Ground Truths, and you talk a lot about like good formalism, and that's kind of what I want to talk about a lot today. Is like what does it mean to be a good formalist? I would like to know maybe some people who you think of as good formalists and what you think they've contributed. And so why don't you start off by saying like, what would you say, like, how would you explain what good formalism looks like in your opinion?
Yeah. So I guess, to give a little background, right. Formalism as a term has been kind of fairly controversial in the last couple of years. I think it's always been a little bit controversial. I think in the history of 20th century art, there's been this moment, I think that the sort of postmodern moment turned us a little against a concentration on form as the thing that's interesting about creative work. Mm-hmm. But I consider myself a formalist. I have not always been, but certainly since I started studying game design and being a game designer, I think of myself as a formalist. But it has become controversial. And I think that the talk I gave was partially just to communicate my own thoughts. I mean, the questions about what a game is and is not and how to talk about them those are questions that have always fascinated me, and so I've sort of just been working on them for a long time. So that was a chance for me to just sort of put it all out, what I think. Mm-hmm. But this idea of good formalism was really a response to the critique of formalism as being kind of essentialist about rules, because I actually agree with that critique. I think that while I am a formalist, I think that there's a way of doing bad formalism, and typically I think that is a kind of formalism that tends to reduce games down to rules and mechanics and goals. And what I wanted to do was to show that you can actually start with that stuff. You can actually take rules and mechanics and goal formation really seriously, which I think all game designers should. I think, you know, that's sort of, you know, I like to say that, you know, painters have, you know, color and texture. The movies, they have sound and light. And what game designers have are possibilities, right? Actions and possibilities. Mm-hmm. That's kind of our medium.
Right.
And so I think you really want to, I think even people who claim that that's not what's important to them, you look at their work and I think they're doing it intuitively. Some of the time they're doing that good work intuitively. So I think what I wanted to do is say, look, you can actually get from rules, from just looking at rules. Like if we say, oh, look, nothing is there but rules. Let's just agree that there's that. Yeah. We don't even have to talk about goals. From there, you can get to a place that I think a lot of people who critique formalism, you know, people like who are in the, like the alt games movement, you can get to the place that they want us to get to, right? And I think that that's, I wanted to do that because I think that's not a bad place to be, but what I want it to have is a good foundation for getting there, right?
Okay.
And to me, that's formal. To put it more simply, I would say that good formalism is a formalism that takes account of players in the system. And I think bad formalism tends to be a type of formalism that ignores players for the most part.
Can you think of a I think I agree with that, but I guess I just don't understand, like, what does it mean to be talking about rules with like without regard for players, because rules are things that apply to the players. Like, that's what a rule is a restriction on players, what they can do. So how, like, can you give me an example of something, of one of those, like, bad formalist sort of ideas of that has nothing to do with the player, you know, that doesn't involve anything regarding the player? Because, like, I can't even conceive of what that would be like. But maybe it's something I know about, but I it's like a miscommunication.
Yeah, I think maybe I should be more specific. It's not to say that it doesn't take players into account at all. It just ends to take a position where players are the recipient of kind of the force of the rules, right? That in my conception, players, that there's kind of this friction between rules and players. And I think typically, you know, what happens when we talk about game design, and for good reasons, right? I mean, because as game designers, that's the stuff we have the most control over. But typically, I think you'll encounter views that tend to look at rules and how they affect players, but don't necessarily extend to what are players doing inside of games, what are they dealing with, and how are they changing things. And it's not necessarily something that I think you'll encounter from the best thinkers typically, but you know, I mean, I think there are folks, you know, I think people I encounter sometimes on Gamma Sutra, I'll read an article that seems to take a position that what we really need to be concerned with is kind of how we structure these reward schedules and how we structure the constraints, and then you pour players into that. I mean, I think I really have a lot of admiration for Dan Cook and his work, but I think that is a critique you could make, is that there is a sense of players as just this kind of force that's poured into a system.
I see.
That, yeah.
Yes, yeah. I think I'm connecting. I would say I probably do look at games as, like, the way I put it is that they're like a machine. And I also think of all, like, arts and crafts as machines. Like a film is a machine and it works. And you know, like, it has an actual functionality to it as it goes through its plot points or whatever that produce a certain value. Like, I do see games as that. And maybe this is rubbing up against the idea that, like, the player is the artist. Is that sort of, like, kind of what you're saying? Like, the player is doing the creative thing?
Yes. I think that it's not, I don't think it's either or. I think that the thing I want to get to is a point, because I think that's also something you'll see, right? So Jesper Juul has sort of talked about the idea that the first kind of wave of game studies from, you know, the early 2000s up, had was very much about, you know, ludology, right? looking at rules and structures and mechanics and trying to understand games as systems, right? And he sort of has talked about the idea that, like, the next wave of game studies has really concentrated on looking at games as they result from players, right? Like games and how players operate in them. And I think you can make just as much the other side. Like, I think you can go just as far wrong in the other direction. So I think, again, someone whose work I admire a lot, but Miguel Sicart, he and I have a lot of disagreements because I think he has this view of games as being kind of unhealthy, right? Like, when games are too systemic, they're kind of oppressive. And so what we really need to do, what we need to do is sort of unleash the creativity of players and let them direct everything. And that is actually sort of healthy and creative. Whereas these sort of thick systems of mechanics and constraints are stifling, mm-hmm. right? And are unhealthy and uncreative. And I think that's going too far in the other direction.
Right. Okay. So I can see how there is that, like, kind of, there's, like, basically we can point to these two sort of, I guess, philosophies. One being that a game is like a machine and the designer makes it, and it, you know, we can judge its value by its rules and its, you know, formal properties. Mm-hmm. And then there's, like, this other point of view that says, well, no, but it's really what the player does with it. My answer to that, like, dichotomy would be that when, you know, like, people like myself, and I think like Dan Cook and others who are trying, and you yourself, who are trying to come up with, you know, how to, like, I think what we're all trying to do is, like, how can we contribute something to a conversation that will allow game designers, the people who are building rule sets, to build better rule sets, right? Like, I think that's a goal.
I think it's a goal. Yeah. I wouldn't say, I guess to that, I would say that that wouldn't be my only goal.
Okay. But that is a goal. And yes. To me, it's like what a player does on the other end of our game. Mm-hmm. You know, like, let's say what they do with it is what matters. How do we as designers control what they do except by what rules and other properties we put into our game?
Right. Well, so my answer is, so part of it, right, is, so I guess my answer to that is that we have less control than we think. And I think we have to, as game designers, we have to start getting comfortable with the fact that we are always kind of, we can make these machines, but we're never going to be able to fully determine how they're used.
Right.
We can only persuade people to use them in certain ways, right? So one of the things, I think the sort of hinge point of my talk, or one of the things that I think is really important is sort of delineation between goals and motivations, right? That I think we as game designers tend to talk about goals as if there's something we have control over. And there's something we should think about a lot, right? Like, it's hard not to design a system with some kind of end point in mind, right? And in fact, I think you can't design a game without having some sense of its dramatic arc or some sense of where it's going, right? I think that's just good design. But what we always have to remember is that that is the one rule we can't enforce perfectly, right? Like, we can make a game, you know, where the player can only do exactly what we allow them to do, but we can't tell them to only do it in certain ways, and we can't tell them to only value certain outcomes. We can't enforce that on them.
Well, doesn't League of Legends? I mean, if a player is not trying to win the game, if they're just griefing their team, mm-hmm. they can be, like, reported, and there is actual, you know, a structure for...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. We can conventionally enforce it, right? Like, you know, if I'm playing baseball with my friends or basketball and I decide that, like, I'm not going to dribble anymore.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, there's lots of conventional enforcement.
But that's enforcement. You know, I mean, who cares if a computer is doing it or if a person's doing it? You know, why does that matter?
Well, I think it matters importantly because rule, well, for one, it's a good way of thinking about the difference between how to design analog games and how to design digital games, which is that digital games tend to have much more what I call material enforcement, right? That like, and I think that that trick, again, that tricks game designers into thinking they have more control than they really do.
Right.
But beyond that, I think it's important to note, right, that like a referee is not a game designer, right? That that like once the game is made, you are always reacting to what people are doing. Because, I mean, right, like, yes, you can enforce it through these systems. But I guarantee you, if everyone in League of Legends decided that, you know, bringing the towers down and destroying the Nexus was not the most fun, then no one would be enforcing those rules, right? Like, the game would change, right? The actual, like, way it was played would completely shift, because at the end of the day, it is only, that goal is only conventionally enforced. And so it's always only as strong as its power to persuade players to pursue it.
Right. So what I agree with is that, maybe a good starting place that will help, I think, clarify these issues is that a given title, like, you know, like League of Legends or whatever, is like what it is determined by the rules that it gets played by, like by a set of rules, you know, abstractly, like whether they're written down on paper or whether they're being played by that or whether they're, you know, coded in on a computer.
You're saying it's entirely determined by that?
Well, I would start there. I would say that that's what the thing is. You know, this set of rules. So if you change one of those rules, technically it's a different thing now, is the way I look at it. So you like,
right.
So League of Legends is some package of rules, including goals, including everything about it. And that's what League of Legends is. And then if you change anything, so like the community is like, oh, we don't want to go for the Nexus anymore. We want to do something else. Now that's a different system now.
Yes.
That's a different game, lack of a better word.
I totally agree, yeah.
Okay, yeah, so...
But I think that's an important thing to realize, right? Like, I think that's the thing, is that I think when we talk about game design, and I'm saying we, I mean, obviously I think there are a lot of different perspectives on it, but I just mean a view I tend to encounter somewhat, is, look, you can make League of Legends, but, like, the metaphor I like to use is when you make League of Legends, quote-unquote, like, if you're Riot, you produce a piece of software. Mm-hmm. Right? That software is really just kind of an incredibly complicated tennis ball, right? Like, you're just going to put this object in. It's not a game yet, right? Because it doesn't have players, and it's not being enacted. So it's just a piece of software. It's just an object, right?
And I would object a little bit to the tennis ball analogy. I would say it's a tennis ball plus a sheet that explains the rules of tennis.
Sure.
And rackets.
Well, I would argue that, fair enough. I mean, I would argue that a tennis ball actually already has a bunch of rules in it
It doesn't have the rules about tennis, you know, like how the scoring system works and all that.
Right. Well, actually, I mean, like, that's the funny thing, right? Is that League of Legends, I feel like, is a lot like That piece of software is a lot like a tennis ball, because it is, you just use it and that's how you figure out how it should be used, right? That there isn't this thing coming with it that says like, oh, you're supposed to do this, you're supposed to do that. In fact, like many video games, right, are actually trying to do as little tutorialization as possible. They're trying to, they're hiding the interim goals for you, right? Like there's a lot actually that games get treated as kind of just these things that people are supposed to already know what to do with. But that's neither here nor there. The point I'm trying to get at is League of Legends puts out this thing into the world. And yeah, it has a lot of things that are telling you how to use it, et cetera, et cetera. But there's no way that Riot can enforce any of that, right? It's just an object. Players are going to come to that object and they're going to look at it and they're going to say, oh yeah, you're right. This is the most fun thing to do with this, right? Because like tennis balls, turns out they're really good for tennis, right? Like why wouldn't you use them to play tennis? But they might just as often come and say like, oh, you know what? This is, I'm bored of this. This is not fun. I'm going to ignore it. Like, let's go all random, all mid, right? Like, sure. Let's just start doing that. And like, there's nothing Riot can do. Right, because they've created something that has its state space, right? A tennis ball has its physics, League of Legends has its state space, but they can never enforce the actual states that the players are trying to get towards, right, or what states they're going to use.
What
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, totally. But I would just describe that as players taking the components of League of Legends. So, like, let's say I made tennis, and I, you know, I produced a ball, I produced a court, and I also gave people a list of rules that explains how tennis works. And then people are like, you know what, I'd actually rather just hit the ball up into the air a bunch of times. They've created a new game. So ARAM is a new game that someone made using the components of League of Legends. Right. That's how I would describe that.
Yes. I'm in complete agreement. I think that it's just it's a problem with the way we talk about games, right? That you and I don't have a good way often of talking about the difference between League of Legends proper and ARAM, right? That we call the, both of those things League of Legends. So we're going to go play League of Legends, and you have no idea what I mean,
right?
Right, and like that's just a problem we have in talking about games, right? I try to sort of drive this home to my students when I sort of talk about Call of Duty, right? That like Call of Duty is this fascinating game where everyone plays Call of Duty, but some people never play the campaign, some people never play multiplayer, and some people play both.
Sure.
And so when you say like let's go play Call of Duty, you have no idea what you're getting into. But it's just this problem of language. But the thing is, our language covers up a very important fact, and this is where I'm trying to get with kind of this idea of good formalism, and trying to, when I say that I kind of agree with a lot of the people that consider themselves anti-formalists, which is that ultimately League of Legends proper, right, any version of League of Legends as a game, not as a piece of software, is itself a kind of social phenomenon, right? It can't be totally defined just by its rules and goals. It is always this kind of social institution that people enter into or exit out of. And so as a game, that is when it becomes a game, when it becomes played in a certain way by at least some group of people or one person or something like that.
So just to clarify that last statement, which I think you kind of lost me there, but like, so League... If Riot made League and no one played it, or like they just played it internally or something, you know, they have 10 people and they just play it 5-on-5 all the time. Yeah. Are you saying that that's not a game, or what are you?
Well, it's a game because they're playing it. But if you made a piece of software and it just sits there on a hard drive someplace, and you're like, oh, I have this great game I made, and someone's like, has anyone ever played it? I think that like what that means is that on some important level, that game has never existed. Because what I'm saying is games only exist properly when they're played.
Okay.
And therefore they have to always be thought of primarily as sort of like a social confluence, you know, like a little social confluence.
So this is another one of those like language things where like, so if I refer to a game, there's something else that we can refer to. So there's that thing that you were just describing that only gets activated once it's played by players.
Right.
And then there is the thing, the actual thing on the hard drive, the set of rules. And we don't have a word for referring to that, but that is a real thing.
We call it software, but we want to define the difference between software that's used for entertainment and software that's used for production. For something more utilitarian, I should say.
I don't like software for two reasons. One is that obviously, you know, plenty of games have nothing to do with computers, but the other reason is that, like you've said, you can't necessarily enforce via software. You can't enforce all of the rules. Like you can't enforce that they pursue the goal. So, like sometimes you might just have to write that down. I suppose you could write down, have a little text prompt that appears, and via software, it is telling the player what the rules are. So maybe that's fine. But whatever, that's just a word thing. But what I wanted to say is that the totally lost my train of thought. What was the thing I objected to of yours?
Here's the thing. I think we agree. I think what you seem to be saying is right. Is that like, well, look, words have lots of different meanings. One of those things is that we use it to refer to a certain kind of software. We reuse it to refer to boxes, right? Boxes that tend to be sorted into right. Like, and I think that's totally fine. I have no objection on that, right? Like, and I think that that's the best thing about language, right? Is that it has a fluidity and a flexibility. But I do think all I was trying to get at was, you know, let's be aware that our language is covering certain things up, and it's making what I think of as very important observations about games harder to make and harder to kind of analyze and philosophize. So it's already very, very hard to even talk about rules and mechanics, right? Like, I mean, there's just, we are in the process of shaping the craft of game design as a profession, as an art, et cetera, et cetera. But there are other conversations, I think, that good game designers should also be having, but it's very hard for them to, because our vocabulary kind of covers up those problems.
Yeah, well, I certainly agree that there's vocabularies, you know, I think everybody kind of agrees that no one can really clearly communicate with each other. And so to summarize what we've been talking about so far, I think the thing that first of all, I don't totally get the idea that a game only exists once it's played. You know, it's like, I understand that a game only delivers its value once it's played. Like, it only, like, becomes, you know, it's of no use to anyone if it's not played, in the same way that anything that a human would use is not used. But, like, we wouldn't do that with anything else. We wouldn't say that a film is not a film until it's watched, would we? That's kind of, or we would, I don't know.
I guess I misspoke slightly. I think I'm making an even stronger statement, which is a game is only a game while it's being played, in an important sense. It's like, in another sense, no, of course, it's a box, it's a piece of software, it's a bat and a glove, right? Those are also games. But in a very important sense, baseball only exists while baseball is happening. League of Legends only exists while League of Legends is happening. While there are players in a system pursuing a goal, right? Searching for the sort of what I call ground truths, right? Moving through a possibility space towards a goal that they've defined. Only when that process is going is that game present in the world. Right.
Well, but the thing is, like, I can have just played a game of League of Legends, and then I go and I look and I read the wiki or something, and I'm mm-hmm. looking at, like, literally the rules, and I'm looking at, like, the abilities of some character or something, and I'm analyzing the rule set of this thing. So it's like, to me, I just think it's weird to use the word game for. I know what you're referring to, and mm-hmm. I think that is a real thing, and it is, like, that there is something there, but it's weird to say that. When no one's playing it, like, let's say everyone took a day off from playing League or whatever,
right?
And on that day, the game doesn't exist. Like, everyone can still have conversations about it. Everyone knows, like, yeah. what it is, and, you know, yeah. there's a mental model everyone has of how it works, and we can debate whether something should be changed to this way or that way, and there's some right, better answer and worse answer, you right. know? So it's like, to me, the game is the conceptual arrangement of items, just as a song, a melody, is the conceptual arrangement of notes, or a film is a conceptual arrangement of plot points. It's not important that they are like of course they won't do anything until someone actually uses them. They're just abstract right. things, but that's not to say that those the abstract collection of information doesn't exist, or that it's not valuable, or that it can't be debated and all the
so first of all, I would say my preferred obviously my preferred vocabulary would be that there's a difference between League of Legends as a game and League of Legends as an institution. That I think makes that distinction a little clearer, but I'm perfectly comfortable with using game to refer to both of those things, as long as we don't confuse them, right? As long as we treat them both with, because I think it is very different to deal with League of Legends as an institution than to deal with it as a game in the moment.
I agree with that completely.
And the other thing I would say is that I guess this might be a point at which you and I do disagree, which is that I just don't think that sheet music is the same thing as a song. Right. Again, we use in the way we use game, we use like, oh, could you hand me that song? Right. And if you know, I mean, the sheet music, you'll hand it. So it works. But I think that like. Right. It's very important not to confuse those two things. It's very important to keep those things very different. And I guess I would say, in a way, yes. Right. That like a film sitting in a can, like Casablanca just sitting in a canister is not Casablanca. Right. Casablanca is film being fed into a projector, light hitting a screen, you know, like that is Casablanca. Like that is the truest form of Casablanca.
Well, in the institutional sense, sort of, right?
No, like when the movie is being played, right? When someone is watching it, right? That is when it is happening.
Well, but like those specific things that you listed, like, you know, a projector and things like that, like we could swap those out for other things. Like we could have like, you know, it could be shown on some, like a Game Boy screen, or like we could have.
Yeah, and I don't think that's Casablanca. I mean, like, I think that, you know, and I'm not a Luddite in this sense, but sure. But I do agree with people who say, look, they're. That when I play My Funny Valentine on a Victrola, right, and then I play it on an iPod, that there's a sense in which that's the same song, and then there's a sense in which that's a very different song.
Right. Okay, so I can agree with that. Like I suppose there's like a No True Scotsman thing about like which one is truly Casablanca that we could argue about, but I accept what you're saying. But I guess what I would say is if you are studying to be a screenwriter, whether you know and so that's kind of where I'm coming from is, you know, I want to learn how to make better rule sets and figure out guidelines so that other developers can, you know, produce better rule sets. And so when you're thinking of things like that way, so if we take it to the Casablanca example, a screenwriter can learn everything that they can learn from the, you know, projected film as they can from the Game Boy version, because that information is still there.
I just don't think that's true. I just totally disagree. I think if you had a screenwriter that had only ever seen movies at like an incredibly low resolution, and not even in black and white, in like the Game Boy resolution, I think they'd be a worse screenwriter. I think that part of being a good screenwriter is knowing what film is capable of, right? Like what it looks like when it's going to hit a theater, because you don't have all the control in the world. Like you're not a camera expert. You might know a little bit about directing. You might know a little bit about acting. Right? Like those things help you because you can't simply divorce your product on the page from where you know it could go when it goes into production.
Right. I guess a better, well, I like, how about a screenwriter just reading screenplays? I mean, people read screenplays like pretty commonly.
Yeah.
And, you know, do you think, like, what's your opinion on that? Is that a way that a screenwriter could learn to write good screenplays, or?
No, I don't. I think that if you're going to be a good screenwriter, you have to watch movies, right? You have to have had the experience. Like, you have to have the end product. You have to experience that end product.
Right.
Because that's who you're creating it for, right? Like if you are just going to write screenplays, like you could be a playwright and never mount a play. Mm-hmm. And you know, you could, like, this is what bugs me about the way Shakespeare is treated, right? That, like, sorry to go on a weird tangent, right? That, like, so many people only know Shakespeare as a writer, and no one, like, far fewer people know of him as performed. And those are two totally different Shakespeares, right? Those like, you, it's just almost impossible to truly appreciate, you know, a Shakespeare play until you've seen it performed, and not just performed once, but performed by like several different like theater troupes, right? To like really understand his genius and how his poetry was written for actors, right? He was writing so that they could bring so many different things. It's not just that he was like a really good wordsmith. It's that he understood acting and he understood staging.
Right.
And that's really what's there, right? That's really what you're trying to get.
I think I overstated what I was saying before a little bit. I do agree that, you know, a good game designer needs to have played games in order to, you know, you can't just design in the abstract completely. Like, however, there are, you know, abstract guidelines. So let's say that the person has seen lots of films, you know, and they do know what it's like to watch a film. Because I think that if, you know, it's like we're painting a particularly crazy example of a person who's only ever watched films on Game Boy. That person wouldn't have the, like, language to communicate properly with people who are watching films. But given, let's say that they have watched a lot of films, my point that I was trying to get at is more that there are, you know, things that can be taken apart in the screenplay itself. You know, like people sit down, film students sit down with screenplays on paper all the time and analyze like line by line and, you know, talk about like, oh, look at this like arc and all that kind of stuff. And that stuff, you know, that, I guess I'm trying to get back to this whole idea of this, the system existing without necessarily being activated.
Right. Right.
Do you see what I'm saying?
I think I see what you're saying. I definitely have seen, like I said, I'm a foremost mostly because as a game designer, I really like talking about their craft. And I do think that there's a lot that can be talked about, right? Like you and I have both had this experience, right? And I think most people, most game designers, I think everyone's had this experience, but game designers have a language to talk about it where you're just playing a game and you like come across a mechanic and you're like, that's really smart. That's really cool. Right? Like that's just a good rule, mm-hmm. right? Like remove from the rest of the experience. That's a good job, right? Like I can recognize the game designer's hand and now I'm going to hopefully be a little bit smarter as a game designer. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, that definitely, like you can appreciate all these parts, right? Like you can appreciate like people who really love film. Like when you listen to film podcasts, which I do a lot of, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they talk about like they can appreciate it on the level of the screenplay versus the level of the cinematography versus the level of the acting, right? And like definitely you can pull all that stuff apart and every single one of those parts has its own incredibly deep discipline.
Right.
Where people are building knowledge bases and best practices and, you know, like absolutely. I think I'm not trying to suggest that that's not possible.
Right. I guess. Okay. So if this is part of like, you know, this whole it's very hard to communicate thing, because like my whole thing is I care about rule sets and I just want right. to figure out how we can make better rule sets. And, you know, I'm not discrediting any of the other aspects of game playing or, you know, producing a game, what it means to produce a good game that and, you know, this whole social aspect of games as an institution.
Right.
But my feeling and where I've come from is like we're the main thing we're building, the main thing that we're delivering to the world is a rule set, and that rule set, like it could be a worse or better rule set depending on like there are better and worse choices that we can make. Just as you just said, oh, sometimes you see a rule and you're like, oh, that's a really smart rule. There's like a lot there. Mm-hmm. And I want to know how we can do that more often. And it seems like when I, you know, sometimes it's kind of a communication thing, but like sometimes when we were talking about games and this whole thing with players, that seems to get kind of in the way of like prescribing better rules, to, in my opinion. Mm. Like, so my big problem is that I don't find a lot of other people. There are definitely some, but there's not a lot of, you know, formalists out there who like say, hey, here's what you should do. This is try doing this. When in doubt, like use this guideline for better design. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if first of all, do you also share that feeling? Do you feel like there's a lot of there's much of that going on, that like, you know, that there's much here's what I've found, do this, or is it that you feel like there is a lot of that, but it's mostly just totally, it comes across at least as totally unusable?
Hmm. I mean, I go back and forth on this because, I mean, like, I can certainly identify with the emotion you're having. but I think, so, like, in one sense, that doesn't seem to be the case, right? We're like drowning in people telling us how to make games, mm-hmm. right? That like all of GDC and all of Gamma Sutra and one of the reasons that I've actually sort of stepped back a little bit from going to conferences as much is that I'm kind of just tired of people telling me how to make games, right? Right? That like I would actually love it if someone was like, oh no, I'm just going to do a kind of breakdown of the phenomenological like properties of this thing, and I just don't want as many takeaways. I'm just drowning in takeaways.
Sure.
So on one level, no, there's clearly a lot of that stuff going on. I think on another level, I do think that there is, in my perception of this, is that we tend to have. We tend to be kind of ignoring. The things tend to be very special casey. So everyone's telling you how to make a game, but what they're really trying to tell you is how to make the game they made.
Right. Yeah.
And the people who aren't doing that, the people who are trying to, even they, I think, are often falling prey to being talking about less than they think they are. So, I mean, I think you and I are sort of very committed to this idea of, if we're going to talk about games, we want them to apply to all games. We are not going to like parcel out, here's what's true about video games, here's what's true about board games, here's what's true about designing a sport, right? Like, those things all have special things about them, but we're interested in having conversations that you can have about all of them at the same time.
Interactive systems design is what I like to say.
Right, yeah. So I certainly, I think, have that feeling. And you know, I think it's reasonable, you know, like, it's, you know, I mean, there's not a lot of money to be made in writing big tomes that aren't about video games. I think, like, that's video. I had a great conversation with a student of mine once where I was trying to sort of make this point to them, and I said, like, video games are amazing because they're like this incredibly bright light that's finally getting everyone's attention. And they're turning around, they're saying, like, oh, games, wow, that's really cool. There's a lot of great stuff going on there. Like, you know, we should, like, let's move towards that. That looks like something that we should invest as much time and attention in as we've invested in literature and film and those sort of things. But it's also such a bright light that all of the games that have already been there are cast into shadow. And people aren't interested in looking at them as much. Or, like, they forget to look at them in the same way that they look at video games, right? Like, it drives me up the wall when people are like, when will games become mainstream? And you can't, like, television is games, right? Like, sports is just, like, one of the most pop, like, athletics and sports and gambling are just woven into almost every society on Earth. The idea that somehow games are not mainstream is just willful blindness or very, very selective.
Right.
And I think that's the thing, is that people say, oh, I really want games to go mainstream. And what they really mean is, I want the games I like to go mainstream.
Sure, sure. I agree with that completely. That actually probably leads us...
I'm sorry, that was a rant. I don't know if that even responded to what you said.
No, this is a good place for ranting. I'm totally welcome. So the word game, we should talk about that real quick. First of all, there's like a colloquial game, you know, like where and I think we all use it that way. The way we've been using it this whole time is, you know, to mean basically interactive entertainment or interactive, you know, art, or, you know, anything that's just interactive systems for people that they can extract value from via their interactivity. Right? Is that, like, that's how people use game, like, at least recently?
I don't know. I mean, we'd have to unpack all of that language. So sure, let's just say yes. Okay. Let's just say sure. That's our working definition for now.
Right. So is that what you usually use? Like, or do you have like a more sort of prescriptive definition that you use with your students? Or do you how do you recommend people use the word game?
Well, I mean, so for me, as someone who's been a game designer and as someone who's always been interested in also the sort of academic discussions about games, I have always tried to keep them very, very separate. Now, obviously, there's going to be some osmosis. I'm a single person. I can't totally separate them. But I tend to be I don't tend to be prescriptive at all with my students about how they should think about games and what they should think. Just because they're my students, and I want them to come to conclusions that work for them and conclusions that they reach on their own. I don't think of it as my job to tell them what I think. I will tell them what I think, and I'll always tell them, hey, I'm talking about what I think now. You can take or leave this. And as a designer, I try to keep that very separate as well. I actually don't... Like, I don't necessarily, when I'm sitting down and working on a game... like the couple of games I'm working on right now, I never think about questions of definition or question. I try to work as intuitively as much as I can. And then if I hit a wall, I look for case studies. I simply look at, like, what are other games doing? And then I keep it. It's very rare that I repair back for me as in my practice. It's very rare that I repair back to a kind of theoretical, a framework, right?
Right.
Now, obviously, again, there's osmosis, right? Like, I have this big, complicated framework, and it does help me think about the biggest effect it has is it helps me to think about the games I like and what I appreciate about them. And so that is that will usually have some kind of effect on what games I'm interested in making. But I don't, because I know you, for you, right, you think of this as being, your framework is very much a kind of active practice, right? You're trying to come up with a method that you feel will make you and other people a better game designer, right?
I was hoping that we could get into that a little bit. But yeah, the basically I feel like there's some kind of very, very low level, like, forms of interactivity or like values that we can get out of interactive, out of an interactive system. Mm-hmm. And so we can like hone in on those. And you know, I think that it's like in every other discipline, you know, we value things that are elegant and things that do a lot with a little, which I guess is just elegance. And, you know, good design. And so I think that honing in on like interactive values is that's kind of like my first level thing that I start with. And I think that other people tend to kind of do that because like they use genre, and genre like gets them mostly there. Like, for example, if they're like thinking like, oh, I'm going to do one of like those, like, I don't know, like a speed runner or like one of those endless runner games or like a match three mm-hmm. game or a shooter. Mm-hmm. A lot, those kind of already come prepackaged with like some of those things that, are in my like definitions. Mm-hmm. But I think that my definitions are, you know, trying to get at the basic things. So like you have like a toy and like a lot of times when we talk about games and you know, and oh, this is a good way to bridge it back to the last conversation. So you know about my like toy form?
Yeah. Yeah, so
that's simple. It's just, you know, there's no goals. Right. And I think that maps quite well to the colloquial use of the word toy. Mm-hmm. So what's weird to me is that like some of the talk about games aren't about rules. They're about player, like what the player does. And is it like kind of like draws into like that kind of thinking just draws us towards making toys. Which isn't like, you know, inherently a problem or anything, but it's like this, that's the bias that I kind of see. And I also feel like, you know, first of all, do you agree with that? Like that, like, since if we're saying that like what the player does and the player's like agency and the player's like choice about everything is kind of where the value is coming from, then it kind of makes sense to make it not have its own goals and stuff. And so I just see this big bias towards the toy design form, and I wonder what you think about that.
I think we've swung back and forth. Years ago, I gave a talk at Games for Change that was called Make More Tennis Balls. And the idea was basically that I felt like game design had gotten too far over into this, like, oh, here are very intricately plotted out, you know, things for a person to do, and they do this, and then they do this, and then, no, they win, right? Like that we had ratcheted down a little bit too much on player creativity in the pursuit of, well, mostly a kind of narrative experience, but also in this kind of idea of, like, very carefully controlling what the player does at any given time, right? That like what we really want to do is create this either really dramatic or really meaningful or really narrative experience.
Right. So real quick, but can I just interject? Yeah. Are you talking about like kind of like railroaded sort of like interactive, like Universal Studios, like you're just going through and you don't even have any interactivity? Is that?
Oh, no, I'm talking about like Gears of War, right? That I just felt like, you know, there was a moment, right, where we really felt like, I really felt like
Gears of War single player or multiplayer?
Single player.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
No, not multiplayer, right? But you know, like I think that there was this moment around the release of the Xbox. Like I think there was this moment, and it's past now, where people really did feel like, oh no, this is what we're gonna get, right? Every game is some version of a first or third person shooter. Every game has, and obviously this wasn't true, right? There were a lot of people making a lot of cool stuff. But I think the conversation was very much around this idea of how, again, like Dan Cook, who again, I admire his work a lot, but he was like literally making charts for like, here's how we can manipulate the emotions of the player at just the right time. So what we need are like these mechanics that like give them this reward and then this, like reward schedules were this huge conversation. And so I just felt like we had lost this idea that there was some level of creativity in the player, and that sometimes the greatest pleasure the player was going to have was watching themselves do something that they didn't think they could do, and that maybe they knew they weren't supposed to be able to do.
Sure.
And you know, that's when I like, because you know, at that point, speedrunning wasn't really appreciated, right? This was long before Awesome Games Done Quick. This was before. The kind of appreciation of esports, right? Esports was around, but no one was really thinking about the idea that, oh, you would just watch people play games and the whole point was that the players were the most interesting thing going on. So it was a bit different world. And now I might agree with you, right, that now in kind of a post-Minecraft world, we're now not thinking enough about how do we structure this experience? How do we think about the rhythm of the encounters in an action game, or how do we think about, you know, why is a player doing this, right? Like giving the player more, like it's okay, in my perspective, it's okay to, you know, provide your players goals, right? Like you know your game, before the player picks it up, you know your game better than they do. You should know what the most interesting thing to do with it is. And I agree that now, and again, this is just where the conversation is. I don't think it's actually where a lot of the design is. You know, now maybe we're talking a little bit too much about this idea that like, oh, you just create a sandbox and they go in and they make their own fun. And it's like, sure. That's cool. That's great. But like, again, maybe pull it back, maybe have more of an appreciation for your own power to structure a really compelling experience.
Right. So my thing is, the way I see that whole thing going down, and I agree with everything that you just said, but I the way I see it is, you know, so we have these extremely restrictive I describe them as like Universal Studios rides. I mean, Gears of War, you can do a little more than that, but like, you know, it's mostly very channeled. There's very little you can do. And then on the other hand, you have just like, you know, toys, which are, you know, you can do anything. And like that, there's something there for sure. But then like, you know, I think what the future is, and like what the real goal should be, is how do we like actually have a very tightly structured rule set, but one which allows for creative, you know, decision making. Like actually, I think that's the best games allow for that. Like they are both of those two things. They have they're extremely structured, but they use that structure as efficiently as possible to allow the player to you know, to really kind of like make these like ingenious and like weird and like come to these conclusions like, oh my God, I can't believe I could do this, you know, in this highly structured thing. And I think that's like the way, and I agree with like this sort of pendulum thing where it's like, oh no, we should have everything just be a roller coaster. Oh no, we should just have it be like a big sandbox.
Right.
But both of those to me we're not like starting to build this like, this thing that we should be building towards, which is, you know, a highly structured thing that, you know, like if you look at any other great, like anytime we've done like great filmmaking or great music composition or anything, it's always like just the amount of structure the amount of like structural design that has gone into it is huge.
Keep going.
Well, that's mostly where I'm going. I'm just saying, you know, that we need to be like moving towards better structural design, and through better structural design, we will enable players to do the kinds of things like we will allow you know, what players can do in a toy in an unstructured environment is it seems like unlimited, but it's actually kind of limited because there isn't like everything they do has very limited meaning in the system. Whereas like when everything is highly structured and there's like this like you talked about a state space and how mm-hmm. everything is sort of like deterministically connected to each other and it's all with respect to this goal that like gives, you know, I don't know if you spoke about that exactly, but that's how I sort of see it in a strategy game, is that mm-hmm. you have this goal and you have all these little like, you know, state spaces, and they're all getting their meaning from that goal, like and everything that's happened before it, and it all informs, and then you finally reach the goal and there's like this charge that goes through the whole system, and like you get this understanding, you're like, wow, I can't believe I could do that thing. And mm-hmm. only with that highly structured sort of system can we enable the player to have those like kind of ingenious, truly ingenious, like creative moments. What do you think of that?
I mean, I think I agree with that. I mean, like, I love that feeling. Yeah, that's a good feeling. That is definitely, I think, a value and a pleasure. I don't know if I can go so far as to say that it is the thing that we should be doing. I think I'm less comfortable making statements, kind of. I worry about blurring aesthetic discussions with moral discussions, right? That like somehow this is it's not just a more beautiful thing, it is a better thing, right? I think I get nervous about that. I mean, because I think that, yes, the thing you're describing is incredible and is amazing, and I love experiencing that. And I think I agree probably with you. I'm not saying that you said this, but what I would say, and maybe where we would agree, is that that is harder to do than many other things,
definitely.
Right? That's just going to take, like, that's just rarer, right? It's not often we have those things that give those things to us.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I do think that there is a place for designing great toys, right? There is a place, and there is an art to that as well, right? I actually think that, you know, there something like Minecraft is brilliant, partially because Minecraft, in kind of the way that we were talking about at the very beginning of our conversation, almost isn't a game. It's a platform, right? It leads people to make games with it. And there are ways it could have been designed as a toy that would have made that harder, right? GTA, it makes that hard, right? But Minecraft makes it easy. And in that way, it's kind of the best toy, right?
Yeah, it's a better toy. I absolutely agree.
Like it's a great tennis ball, right? A tennis ball, like tennis balls are some of the most fun because it turns out there's just a lot of things you can do besides playing tennis with tennis balls.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that goes back to the thing that you just said, though, where you were like, well, I don't know about this thing. Like, people should. Mm-hmm. The reason people should is, like, I'm assuming that they want to make a better X. If they want to make a better toy, then it's better to do some of the things take some lessons from Minecraft than from GTA, you know? Like,
yeah.
And that's all I mean in the should sense. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I'm always, I would say, keeping in mind, right, that those aesthetic qualities are really culturally contingent on some level, and that aesthetics shift over time. That I don't think it's clear. Like, I think that's why it's hard. Like, part of why it's hard to make a great toy is that what we want to do with toys changes over time.
Well, to push back
on, and right, okay. Yeah, so go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, do you think there's any, like, because it seems to me that there are melodies that were written hundreds of years ago that, like, still just, like, work when you listen to them now. And, you know, and so in the same way, like, I think there are some things that, like, kind of just work. And I wonder if, like, we can discover those things about interactive systems and, you know, and then it won't be so sensitive to what the, you know, the current cultural climate is.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question, right? Because I don't know. I mean, right? Like, I think that this like just gets to the heart of the whole difficult question around aesthetics, right? Which is like, to what sense, like, why do I associate major chords with something triumphant? Mm-hmm. Like, is that a thing about humans? It doesn't seem that like that's the case. And then like, why do I like harmony rather than dissonance? Are there people who like dissonance? Is that something about being human? You know, is it something about being human that is biological? Is it something about being human that is just so culturally ingrained from the very beginning that it feels natural? Like, I think that these are hard questions. And I think these are interesting and cool questions. I don't know. I might despair a little more than you about whether or not answering those questions would actually help us make a good game. Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, I whenever I talk about tuning, right, like I really love tuning. It's one of my favorite things to do in game design. And one of the interesting things about tuning, right, is that like it's really easy to find wrong answers. But that for whatever, but there's still like an almost infinite number of right answers. Right? You can find either end of like you can have like a jump height and you can find, well, that's way too high or that's clearly too low. But then there's this middle that is functionally like, that's not I think a solvable problem, like what that should be. It's always an aesthetic question. It's always a matter of taste.
Always?
So I think in that middle ground, once we have gotten rid of all of the wrong answers, which I think it's useful. It's useful to find the wrong answers, but I think it's easier to find the wrong answers than we realize. I think we're kind of always doing it without realizing it.
Could that be because we're used to dealing with like systems that have a low amount of structure and like that are kind of toy-like, if not straight up toys? And in those like less structured systems, there you can get away with like a lot, and that's why that we have these, like, for example, like if you take something that is heavily structured, like a board game like Puerto Rico or something, mm-hmm. that like, oh, there's all this wiggle room, like, becomes way less true. Like there's very little wiggle room. And
I don't know that I agree with that.
Yeah, like you.
I don't know that.
If you scale up, like if you scale up the price of a building in Puerto Rico or down by one gold, which is the smallest mm-hmm. amount that there exists, it mm-hmm. like breaks the whole thing. Like it, like it's just, oh, that's just, that's,
well,
useless,
of course.
Now.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. So like there.
But the thing is, that's only true in that everything else in that game was already tuned to the levels it's at.
That's what I mean by structure, though. That's what I mean.
But
like,
that's, but the problem is that I still don't think that makes the question easy, right? And I still don't think that means that there's a right answer. What you can say is, given all of the remaining, given all of the tuning that exists already in Puerto Rico, this shouldn't be any different.
Right.
Right. But that's like doing a crossword, right? It's like, yeah, this word's easy to fill in because we've got all the other words.
Well, no.
But like, if you don't have Puerto Rico already, there's no way of saying how should all these things be tuned. The only answer is taste. I think to a certain extent, you can always find the ones that are wrong, right? It's just a bad idea to have a magic deck with 175 cards in it.
Well,
that's wrong. And it's bad to have five.
Yeah.
But what's the answer between? That's hard. That's contingent. That depends on a huge number of variables that I'm not sure where I'd love it if we could. Well, I despair at the idea that we're going to find a set of calculations that are going to let us find that.
I guess I just want to make clear what I'm saying. Like if I were designing Puerto Rico, you know, I start designing this part. I just start designing this. I have these scaffoldings and I'm making it. And eventually I get to a point where, okay, I have to decide on the cost of this building. And like, you know, I can scale that up and down, and I can scale a couple other things down and up and down. But eventually I do like reach this like balance point where everything is coming together and like all the structures are kind of like meeting each other. And you know, and have this like this you know, just this point of balance, and there is like a correct answer, like given
well,
the rest of the system.
Well, yeah, like I said, it's not that there are not correct answers. It's just that there are so many correct answers that deciding between them is purely a matter of taste. Like you can reach that one kind of peak in the possibility space of all the levers you're pulling on Puerto Rico, But you can pull all those levers probably and find a different peak.
Oh yeah,
right? Like you can create a lot of good answers. And so in the end, the problem remains, which answer do you want to choose?
Sure.
So and that's not a, that's, I can't, like, as a game design teacher, I can't tell my students what they should, that's just their taste. That's just, they got to look around. They got to do what feels good to them. They got to do what feels good to other people. They got to think about what matters more, what feels good to them, or what, you know, like, that's just a hard problem of taste. Well, and, yeah. And yeah, and taste is shifting constantly, right? I mean, that's like, true. You just look at something like the development of something as simple as a shmup, right? There's not a lot of, like, there are more than there used to be, but like there aren't as many levers in a shmup as there are in StarCraft. And yet clearly tastes have changed and shifted, and we get a lot of different types of things, and all of them are right answers, right? Like, I prefer Galaga to many contemporary shooters because I just like that balance more. That doesn't mean, like, Galaga's not bad. It's not like we've learned new things about how to make shooters. We've learned some new things, but that didn't retroactively mean that Galaga was the wrong answer. And, you know, then you get Super Hexagon, which is basically a shmup with no bullets, right? It's like the same feeling that you get from that, but it's one of those levers is pulled all the way to zero, which would have probably never occurred to anybody, right? That would have seemed like a wrong answer, but it turns out, again, you just pull these levers in the right order, and all of a sudden, you don't need enemies. Right. And yet you're getting the same feeling. You're getting that same, right?
Yeah, no, I think we agree. I think the for any given, like, what you're actually going to design in the first place, you know, that is, I wouldn't go as far as you, I think, are going, which is to say that it can't be understood, like, why, you know, like, there's no accounting for taste. I think that we can actually account, like it's very, very difficult, but we can kind of explain, like, oh, why I like this, why I chose to do this, like, why. And I do think that every, like, we can say, like, this is, like, a slightly better aesthetic than that. I mean, we, you know, we can come up with extreme examples.
I think we can. I think that more often than not, those are post hoc determinations. I think that you can, right? You can account for taste. You just can't predict it.
Well, I would say it's very, very hard to predict it. But as game designers, that's our whole job. I mean,
oh no, yeah. It's the job. But that's what I mean when I say, like, I keep coming back to this word despair, right? It's like, oh, I wish that this was easier. I wish I knew. I mean, maybe I don't, because then this games wouldn't be interesting. It's right. That's what makes games interesting, is making a thing that, like, you know, when you fire up a game and you're like, this literally, like, checks off all of the things I want, and I don't like it, and that's surprising, and that's disappointing, right? I want to play games I like, but it's also really fascinating to be challenged and to say, like, oh, I didn't know what I liked, or I didn't know what was going to be popular. Like that's the struggle. The struggle's real, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I mean, the despair thing, I completely agree with. It's super hard, and we probably won't get it right. But I also feel like there's this element of, like, oh, it's unknowable, and it's, like, literally impossible to predict, and, like, we can't know anything about it. And right. There is that kind of strain out there, and that I'm always kind of like, I feel like that strain should be pushed against, because it's kind of like counterproductive. It's like, we got to come up with answers. Like, we have to come up with answers. So let's figure out what tools can we use to come up with better answers? Like, we have to do it anyway. So there's no point in, you know, sort of, giving up.
Well, I think I agree with that. I think that, like, as far as pushing back on that, I don't think that's really anybody's fault. I think one of the problems we have as an industry and as a community is that, you know, we reward people who are, we kind of expect the great artists to also be great intellectuals, right? I think this hangover from the days when we thought we were engineers. It means that, like, oh yeah, obviously to become a better game designer, you go and you go to conferences and you listen to the person that made a really good game or a game everyone likes, and then you take notes and then you go home. The problem is, those people probably don't know why their game is good. Like, they're as confused as you. They're doing the process of just trying to figure out what they did right. And that's okay. That's great. And so you have those people that, like, they're not even, I think, even they, I think, for the most part, would not say, like, I am trying to lay down the law. I'm not, like, these are not the 10 commandments of design. They have to talk that way because GDC only allows you to give a talk if you have takeaways. But I think, like, in their hearts, that's, they know that they're just doing this post hoc. They're just trying to say, like, yeah, I made a thing, and this seems to be what I like about it and what other people like about it. I don't think, if they're being honest with themselves, they wouldn't have seen that that's what it was going to come out to, right? They may have felt it while it was developing, but they didn't sit down and have a plan. They didn't have this list of takeaways before they started the game, right? That list of takeaways came after they finished it. So there's that. And then there's the problem of, like, I think we need to get more comfortable with the idea that some people are best when they're not forced to articulate themselves, mm-hmm. right? That, like, it's not fair to take someone like it's not fair. It's not useful to take someone like Jonathan Soderstrom and have him explain how to make game. Like, he doesn't know.
Sure.
And, like, that's great because he's just a, you know, sometimes you need a few in any creative community, you need some people who are just an open nerve. They're just picking up the vibes.
Sure.
And they can't tell why they like a thing, but they just do it. And
yeah,
it works.
Well, they do probably have an understanding, but it's an intuitive understanding that they're not necessarily right. prepared to verbalize.
Right.
But
right.
we all have that. That's
And I would go slightly farther than that. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, I would go slightly farther to that in that it might make them worse as creators to force them to do that, right? That like forcing them to verbalize that is only going to make them more self-conscious and more aware of their own process in a way that process needs to stay unexamined in order for them to operate at their best level.
Maybe. I wouldn't say that's certainly the case. Maybe it could do the opposite. Maybe it could actually make them better designers.
It could,
you know,
but it's a danger. It's a danger.
Sure.
I think you're
sure.
taking a risk.
yeah. And I agree with that. Anyway, we're coming up on like a little over an hour, so I'm going to wrap it up. But I did want to ask you a couple things, just like, you know,
sure.
random-o questions. We could go on with this theory stuff probably forever. There's like so much.
I know, we could. This is too much fun. This is too much fun, Keith. You might have to have me on again sometime.
No,
maybe I'll start
to.
My podcast and then you come on mine.
That would be amazing. I would love to be in that list of names that you have.
All right.
A couple things. One, what are you working on now? You mentioned you were working on a couple of projects, just personal projects, or do you have any on commercial games or anything?
Well, you know, you never know. I have several things I'm working on. I always have events and stuff that I'm doing at the center here. I'm working on a little. I don't want to talk too much. Again, I try to work intuitively, so if I try to verbalize it too much, I get derailed. But I'm working on like a little strategy game. I'm a big fan of the Civ games and of that kind of style of strategy games. And I'm someone, I actually admire your practice a lot because I think that I really like that you are interested in making things that no one has seen before, right? That like you talk about board game design as being so interesting because they are so different, right? There are clearly genres, but there really seem to be, am I misquoting you?
No, that's good.
So I mean like you're really interested in like pushing those, like founding new genres and pushing out what we think of, like, and I personally as a designer really like working in genre. I'm very comfortable there. So I'm working on kind of a me experimenting with the space of Civ games and SimCity games, and we'll see. It's very slow because I'm not a very good programmer, and I'm being a perfectionist about how things look and that sort of. But so there's that. I'm working on a card game that is called Cabal. Or at least that's the title at the moment. It's not really in genre, but it's inspired by Hanabi, but I'm trying to do something that's like Hanabi, but a little bit more, a little bit more gamey, I guess might be the
sure,
word,
sure.
right?
A little strategy game-ish more, like a
Well, it has
that.
Some strategy. Well, actually, it has a little bit more Go Fish in it. It's like
sure.
There's a little bit more mystery. So we'll see. I have kind of a working version of that, but I'm trying to work on a version that works with just two players, and then maybe think about theming that and releasing. Well, not right now. It's just a regular 52 card deck game. So maybe think about theming that and figuring out special cards and maybe doing a commercial release. And then I'm currently working as a producer. On a game that I'm developing with a recent graduate here named Gabe Cazillo. He has a two-player game called Foiled, which is a little fencing game. Mm-hmm. And we're working on revamping that with new art and building an arcade cabinet. And I have a kind of research project to figure out if arcades are coming back. And I want to test if whether or not, you know, we have this big influx. We have this big scene right now of kind of barcades. Like every major city has a kind of barcade. And Killer Queen, I don't know if you know Killer Queen.
Sure, the team player.
I'm a big fan of Killer Queen. I run our weekly tournament here at the Game Center. And that's had a lot of success there. And I want to test the idea that maybe our games coming back, are those audiences interested in new games, mm-hmm. right? If games that are made for that audience, right? Simple controls, inviting graphics, kind of taking some of the things we've learned from casual game design since the death of the arcades, right?
Yeah.
And seeing if that's worse. So that's these are all, who knows how long these things will take, but those are my current projects that I'm working on.
Cool. Yeah, that sounds pretty cool. So the other final thing I wanted to ask you is, you mentioned podcasts. Are you a big podcast guy? You listen to a lot of podcasts?
I do listen to a lot of podcasts.
Do you have any favorites that you want to, like, you talked about movie podcasts. What are your favorite movie podcasts?
Oh, yeah. Well, I really like the Slash Filmcast. Uh-huh. I don't know. It's just one I found, and I kind of like the personalities on it. And
do they talk about horror movies?
Sometimes. Oh, yeah. No, it's actually Slash as in like backslash.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Slash Filmcast is good. I enjoy that a great deal. There's another one, there's like a little comedy podcast I listen to that has Jeff Cannata and Anthony Carboni on it called We Have Concerns, which is a really hilarious little kind of science comedy improv show. They're just like 20, 30 minutes long. And they do it 3 times a week, and it's great. I just like I look like an idiot on the subway, just sort of sitting there laughing to myself. But nice. That's great. I mean, I have other podcasts that I kind of dip in and out of.
Any game design podcasts that you like?
Well, other than yours,
other than mine, of course.
You know, not as many as you would think.
Yeah.
I kind of dip into I like the Gamers with Jobs podcast, okay. the conference call they call it. I don't know why I started listening to them a long time ago. I think it's interesting because it's a bunch of people. This is weird to say, but it's a bunch of old white men.
Sure.
And I feel like we only hear from young white men, so it's actually really refreshing to hear these guys who have families and jobs
in there.
Yeah, some diversity. Beyond that, do I listen? I mean, sometimes DLC, but not very recently. I mean, I think DLC, it's that's also another Jeff Cannata. But I actually really, maybe I'm just a Jeff Cannata fan. He's on Slash Filmcast, We Have Concerns, and DLC.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I don't know. Like, I don't. I mean, like, so one of the problems I often have is that I don't like the way podcasts in games are done, because I don't like the whole get four drunk people together and hear them talk with next to no structure for 3 hours. Like, I just don't like it. This is kind of a lot of what there is out there. And so I find myself, I really liked Steve Gaynor's podcast that he was doing for a little while, because he was doing kind of another Castle style, talking to developers about why they make games, et cetera. I really like Soren Johnson.
Yeah, I was going to just say.
Yeah, Designer Notes, I think is what it's called.
Yeah,
I like that a lot, although I wish he had a little bit more discipline as far as time goes. Like, I really love Rob Pardo, but 4 hours of Rob Pardo, like, I think you could have structured that where I got a lot of the good stuff out of Rob Pardo. But,
yeah,
you know, also, on the other side, it's nice to hear Rob Pardo just shoot the shit for 3 hours. So
sure, yeah.
I like those. Those are the ones. Yeah, that's probably. I have a Game of Thrones podcast that I listen to. But
okay, that's cool. Yeah. All right. Well, that probably should wrap it up, because this has been awesome. And so, thank you so much for coming on the show. And we'll have to do it again at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Keith. I had a great time.
All righty. So
oh, nice. All right.
Yeah,
so we're both dropouts. We're both high school dropouts.
Yeah, yeah.
I should have mentioned that at the beginning of the podcast. Maybe people need to know that. That's full disclosure. You're going to listen to two high school dropouts talk about games for an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah.